It's late. You've been at work all day and you're tired. That's when you make a fateful decision to open one last email and click on an innocent-looking link, and then the screen goes blank and a message pops up. Your files are locked. Pay up or you'll never see your data again. But it's not just your files. The virus has spread throughout the organisation and the consequences are dire. Now, it's an all too common story. Ransomware attacks are happening all the time. And to explain what's at stake and what might be done to avert disasters, plural, I'm joined by Kara Frederick. Kara is an associate fellow in the Technology and National Security Program at the Center for New American Security in Washington, D.C. But she previously worked for Facebook, where she helped create and lead their Global Security Counterterrorism Analysis Program, and before that, a senior intelligence analyst with the U.S. Department of Defense. So she comes to our little wireless program with awesome credentials. Kara, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kara, you're in Texas, and I understand the Lone Star State was recently targeted by a series of coordinated ransomware attacks. What happened?
Exactly. So in about mid-August, there was a series of simultaneous ransomware attacks that hit about 23 cities in Texas, so across municipalities. And what that did was it's really evincing this trend that we're seeing over the past 2 years, where you have new strains of ransomware that target entire organizations by single users. So the scenario that you posed in the beginning of the program, where there's a phishing email, you click on it, and then all of a sudden your computer and your data, your files are all locked up for a price. That is sort of mutating and evolving. We're looking at strains of ransomware that actually allows attackers to conduct series of connected attacks across multiple areas at the same time, because they're targeting something like one managed service provider, which is shared by multiple cities. And that means that attackers get much bigger bang for their buck. When you talk about return on investment, these attackers are seeing that targeting one entire organization that can hit a bunch of places at once, that is going to be more effective. You look at certain strains like SAMSAM, which follows this pattern. It extorts about $50,000 per attack, vice your typical established commodity ransomware strains like Gavin Crab, which only extort about $500 per attack. So when attackers see that, they're like, okay, we're going to go with being able to target multiple places at the same time, vice just single users locking up one single computer. It's really pernicious.
Now, the New York Times recently told us that more than 40 municipalities were hit by cyber attacks this year, and that affected businesses reliant on local government as well as systems related to emergency services.
Exactly. So, and this is the problem. Municipalities right now are seen as low-hanging fruit. And that's for a variety of reasons, right? So like you mentioned, these attacks are highly visible because they disrupt public services. These are, you know, water, power, police departments, hospitals, critical services that could actually have real impacts, not just financial, on people's lives. Hospitals in particular, as we already talked about. You know, these municipalities are easy targets because they're not updating their systems. They're not consistently patching their systems. And they really don't have the budgets and the resources to have robust IT departments or, you know, for cybersecurity. And then finally, there's one thing I think is really important here is the willingness to pay these ransom incentives. You look at Lake City, Florida, Riviera Beach, Florida, Jackson County, Georgia. I mean, this is a total of over $1 million in Bitcoin paid. And once these groups see that they can profit off of the insurers for these municipalities, they're going to do it again. And they're going to put that money back into their research and development programs, I say programs in quotes, to increase the effectiveness of future attacks.
Kara, you mentioned payments by Bitcoin. Is that the preferred currency these days?
It is. It is, unfortunately.
Okay, now the FBI says don't pay the ransom, but that's easy to say and hard to follow, because look at, say, the city of Baltimore decided not to pay after they received a demand of some $76,000, and their experience was salutary.
Yeah, and this is the problem, right? When you, like you said, in May 2019, Baltimore was attacked, and right now it's estimating that approximately $18 million is what it's going to take to, you know, restore lost wages and those servers and whatnot. Atlanta is a good example of this as well. Attacked back in March in 2018, they're estimating about a $17 million restorative cost. And when you put those millions of dollars up against the Bitcoin requests, in Atlanta, it was a $51,000 Bitcoin request. And that was the SAM strain of ransomware attack, too. So, yeah, these cities are making the calculus that would we rather pay this amount in Bitcoin or would we rather pay millions and millions of dollars to restore our servers and get back online? But what the FBI is saying, and I agree with this, is these ransomware attackers, once they figure out that you're going to pay up, once they figure out you have the insurers who are going to pay up, too, they're likely to do it again. They're likely, and I brought this up earlier, they're likely to take the money that they get and use it to get better at ransomware attacks. They're likely to, you know, put it back into their research and development in order to get more precise with their attacks, to get more efficient. So do you want to keep doing this endless cycle, you know, for the rest of your city's existence? I don't think so. So that's a calculation that cities have to make, but I'm on the FBI's side in this one.
Kara, so a city like Baltimore is unable to collect rates and revenue. It's got to rebuild all its databases, as you point out, at vast cost. And what happens when the payment is made? Is the data invariably unlocked?
You bring up a great point. No, when this has happened in some smaller cities as well, and especially with a single user targeting too, when people pay up, there's no guarantee that the criminals after all, are going to actually release the data. So you're sort of relying on the goodwill of thieves at this point to be good on their word. And, you know, to me, and the FBI brings this up as well in their admonitions not to pay, are you going to trust a criminal who's already taking your data hostage? It's kind of like I worked in counterterrorism for almost 10 years, and it's why America doesn't negotiate with terrorists, right? There's a long history of reasons why we don't do that. It's kind of the same with ransomware, and at least we're consistent.
How sophisticated are the ransomware attacks, Kara?
So they're getting better, and this is a problem. Like I talked about before, the more established ransomware strains are really good at locking up those single users. The way that these are spread are through phishing, and you talked about it earlier in the program. Phishing is a type of social engineering that sort of manipulates people into clicking on a link and infecting their devices, or effectively installing malware on their devices. And there's in the States at least, there was a OMB report, the Office of Management and Budget report for fiscal year 18, that basically said federal civilian agencies had over 31,000 cyber incidents, and 7,000 of those were through phishing alone. So that's important.
31,000 of them.
Exactly. And 27% people couldn't even figure out where these were coming from and you know, exactly identify the vector of the attack. And the fact that we can solidly say that 7,000 of these were through phishing alone, that highlights the importance of social engineering to these attackers, to the effectiveness of these attacks. But other types are, you know, using remote access software. I don't know if you've ever been on the other end of a computer where you have something like a managed service provider, these companies that manage IT systems for a bunch of different organizations, where they sort of say, okay, can I have remote access to your computer to figure out what's wrong? It's kind of like that. It's when attackers use that software to install exploit kits and push ransomware onto the network. So there's a whole vulnerable ecosystem that we need to be aware of, and phishing is usually what starts that one little Trojan horse grain entry into the system.
You use the term phishing. Are any of these naughty people caught? Are they being charged?
Sometimes. So there was the SAM attacks. So the strain of ransomware visited against Atlanta back in 2018. So there was an indictment against a few Iranians. And ever since then, we've kind of seen I would call it a little bit of a denouement of the SAM attacks. So sometimes they are. Attribution is very important. You've probably heard of the WannaCry attack in 2017, a state-sponsored North Korean attack, which affected 200,000 and computers and caused billions, billions with a B, in damage worldwide. That was spread via phishing. And we know that the North Koreans did it. So it's the attribution part is one thing, but in order to actually impose costs and punish, especially these nation state actors who are visiting these attacks against, you know, worldwide hospitals, the national health system in Britain was affected in the WannaCry attack in 2017. So the idea there is we have to call these people out, call these nation states out. We did one of our old cybersecurity advisors in the White House, Thomas Bossert, basically said in a Wall Street Journal op-ed in 2017, the North Koreans did this. So I think that is an important step in actually bringing these attackers in to justice. But it's,
but
Donald doesn't go far enough.
Your president can surely fix that with a phone call. He gets on so well with North Korea. Now, okay, let me ask you this. The most alarming part of your warning is, to me, the concern that electoral rolls could be equally vulnerable to attack, to interference, and potentially ransom, which would, of course, undermine the entire confidence in the electoral system.
Exactly. And it's that perception. And even if, you know, certain nation state actors or cyber criminals, even if they don't get at the actual databases and altering the data itself, just the perception of undermining our democratic institutions, that is a victory for people who are trying to, you know, cut down on the freedoms of the world. So that is, I think, number one, the biggest thing that we have to protect against is that perception that this could happen. But what is ransomware other than something that effectively gets that data and locks it up and attempts to alter it? So we're worried that voter registration databases could be targets here, where ransomware could potentially lock, or attackers could lock up data at specific times, like during an election. Short of materially altering that data itself, that is a big problem too.
Kara, you're talking to a quaint and old-fashioned country where we still vote with pencil and paper. And it sounds all of a sudden like we should keep doing it. Look, how to guard against and prevent attacks? This is your speciality. What can be done to secure state and local government systems?
Yep. So there's a couple things here. Technical, and there's policy ideas too. So on the technical side, we have a new organization that was created by the Department of Homeland Security in 2018, and it's called the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. And what they basically do is they have a blueprint for states to technically shore up and harden their systems. I advise follow it. Protect and secure your systems in the near term and in the long term. So in the near term, you can back up your data, keep a copy offline. I like that a lot of states are looking at introducing paper-based voting systems, you know, like you just mentioned. States need to update and patch their systems. The consistent patch management is critical, so stay on that. And then make sure your security solutions are up to date. Use firewalls, make sure you're running your security products. And then there's also the cognitive element too, like we talked about. If something doesn't look right, there's a funny looking link in your email, if the IRS is sending you emails, you should pause, think about it. You know, am I being fished here? Is there something, if something seems off, it probably is off. So I advise pause, take a moment to think about it before clicking. Don't get emotional. If something is talking about your bank records and your financial paper trail, don't get emotional. Pause before you click. And then in the long term, states can collaborate with the federal government to work with places like the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Agency on capacity building. Take their advice and also just front load your investment in securing digital infrastructure from the beginning. When I worked at Facebook, a lot of these security centers, they're a cost center. Now they don't think about these cybersecurity and information security institutions as cost centers. They think of them as a priority, not necessarily an afterthought. States and local governments should do that as well. And then when you talk about nation state attackers like the North Koreans, we believe that one strain of ransomware where Ryuk is more than likely it operates outside of Russia. A cybersecurity firm talked about that in the U.S., CrowdStrike, a few months ago. So when it comes to these nation-state attackers, we have to make sure we're imposing costs on them as a government, as a nation, with our allies. We're defending forward to prevent them from sort of attacking any systems that we and our allies use too. So I think those are really, really big data points that state, local governments, and nation states and allies can really seriously think about when it comes to ransomware.
Kara, you're talking to an ancient technophobe, but I want to finally ask you about AI, particularly with machine learning. Does that make it easier for the perps of malicious attacks or harder?
Oh, easier. So, you know, there's always a give and take, right? In technology, there's a cat and mouse game. We talk about a lot in technical governance, you know, the technology pretty much outpaces our ability to govern it. So what does that mean? It means that attackers have an advantage here, and the data defenders are pretty much on the back foot. So they develop the technology, we figure out how they're using it for nefarious purposes, so we find ways to defend against it, and then they come up with another way to attack. So it's like terrorists, right? So if you figure out how they're communicating, they find another way to communicate. Okay, you can prevent that, and then they come up with another way. So it's that give and take, that push and pull that happens all the time. And this is very similar with artificial intelligence. I mean, it's going to help automate these attacks. So it can help automate spear phishing at scale, which is basically increasing odds of attackers' success by saturating the attack surface. You know, this is a huge attack surface in the future for bad actors to exploit. I write about how in the 30 years since the first ransomware attack in 1989, there's going to be approximately 30 billion devices connected to the internet by next year. And then 5 billion people are going to have access to the web in the next 5 years too. And that, I mean, bad actors can really, really run amok. And I think political campaigns, electoral systems are really in their sights.
Kara, you are a terrifying guest, but thank you very much. And I should point out that Kara got up very early to take our call. We are most grateful. Kara Frederick, Associate Fellow in the Technology and National Security Program at the Center for New American Security in Washington, D.C.